I don't know what to say, really. The biggest battle of our professional lives all comes down to today.
You've got to tell me on the gut, and on a determination, you've got in your body.
It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
Well, there you go. We've got a brand new opener to the show. It is the Coach's Corner podcast right here. Thanks for joining us. MyPodcastHouse.com. Mark Sefoulis, good day to you.
G'day, Shebex. What an awesome intro put together by our very own George Voyatsis, the voice of the tennis podcast on the Baseline as well. So thank you to George for putting that together. But we are joined by an extremely special guest and someone who, Shebex, yourself and I have known for a little while, and we've worked together with her at the Maribyrnong Sports Academy, where she is the baseball and softball head coach alongside your great self, Shebex.
No, I'm just the assistant.
Just the assistant. But no, she's a super coach, but was a super athlete in her own right. She represented Australia for 352 games, captain in 2005 and 2006 as the catcher of the team. She's an Olympian in 2000, 2004 and 2008. Three-time Olympian, Shebex. One silver medal and two bronze medals. And this year has returned to play local footy for the first time. Age 40, is that right?
We'll say around 40.
Around 40. Okay, so Natalie Titcombe is our special guest today on the Coach's Corner. Natalie, thank you so much for your time and for being here in the studio.
Oh, thanks, Sue. Thanks for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure. We are super excited. This is a great podcast where we like to get the insights of many coaches, and you're a really different case in that you've had such a great athletic experience. And I want to really tap into that a little bit at the start. So I did mention you're a three-time Olympian. How does that feel when people mention that you are a three-time Olympian?
Oh, look, it's great to go down memory road all the time. And I think it's hard being an ex-athlete or an ex-elite athlete to then take on teaching the new era of athlete. And for them to get to understand, as you know, the game changes, athletes change, and for you to still try and link and communicate with them is still going to be a challenge. So, you know, you still want them to look to say, look, there's nothing that I'm asking you to do that I wouldn't have done myself. And for them to look past the fact that you're 40 now and to think, well, when I was doing these things, it wasn't yesterday. You know, it was a few years ago. So that's always a challenge in itself. I find that sometimes my brain still thinks I'm 20, but obviously my body doesn't believe it's 20, let's just say.
It is a bit of a shame our bodies have to age because our minds want to continue to compete, don't they?
Mate, there's got to be a special cure out there at some point, you know, the cartilage or just a special injection that you can take, but we won't go down that line. We know that didn't end well for a certain team, so that's not something that I'm actually warranting to go ahead with there, but on a personal note, it'd be nice to have a little special miracle cure, I guess, to stay in your 20s.
Absolutely. Wouldn't it be nice? And you represented Australia in 2000. That was your first Olympic Games. Let's take our listeners back to that moment when you were selected probably for your first Olympics. How did it feel? And, you know, what was going through your mind at that particular time?
Well, I guess in 96, I went as the travelling reserve. So it was kind of a bittersweet that I had to wait 1,362 days for that next phone call to say that you've actually made the team this time. So for my friends, family, every coach, every player, every teammate that I've been a part of, I think I rang everyone that I possibly could to say, hey, I've made it. I'm actually playing at my home Olympics. And that happened about 6 months out. So our team selection was actually quite early. So I think it was good in a way from my perspective. We did have a few team members that I guess get caught up in the I've made it, so now I'll take the foot off the pedal. But for me, it was I made it, I want to tell everyone possible, and then it's down to work.
Yeah, that's good.
But it can go two ways.
Absolutely. That would have been a really exciting moment for you and your family, obviously, in that stage. Obviously, it was 2000 in Sydney, so
yep.
Home Olympics is not often on the cards for most of the athletes around the world. So what was it like representing Australia at the Sydney Olympic Games?
Oh, look, I mean, where the actual softball field was where I actually grew up, like less than a kilometre from where I was actually born. So
it's a real home ground advantage.
To say it was my backyard, it was my backyard.
Absolutely.
And I certainly did treat it like that, and I wanted to ensure that, you know, you come to my house, it's my rules and we're here to win. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it was fantastic, and just to have constant support for 2 weeks in the actual games, but for the months leading up and even afterwards, it was just phenomenal. Everyone was just, it was like they were in a euphoric moment for about 6 months in Sydney. It was probably the best time to be in Australia.
Absolutely. So let's look at, you went from 2000, let's go fast forward to 2008, which was your, obviously the third Olympic Games that you competed in.
Yeah.
What changed from you as an athlete between those 8 years? How did you, you know, if you look back, did you do some things as an athlete that you thought and you cringed at, you know, in 2008, you go, oh, geez, in 2000, I really wasn't, you know, ready for it? Or, you know, what do you think about that, the difference in that 8 years?
You know what, definitely it was a life experience helps, dealing and coping with opportunities that come your way and understanding that you don't have to do it at 100 miles an hour was a massive thing. I guess I learned that I could actually train harder than I was, even though I thought I was training hard. I got the opportunity in 2006 to go and play in Japan and to be just one of the players, one of 22, and train and be exactly like them. So I really learned, and I couldn't talk. You know, you can't just stop and have a chat to somebody and say, this is what I'm doing. It was all about action. So there was no words. I had to act. I had to lead by actions. I couldn't just sit back and say, hey, I'm already a two-time Olympian. I had to actually get out there and show my teammates, which was probably one of the best things for me because, you know, without words, it all becomes about action. And you know, when you can't speak the language or you can only speak it through an interpreter, you never get through. So it is all about learning to act and always acting in the right way, always being competitive, always being positive, though, in your competition.
I love that. I'm going to go to a quote that I looked online. I just researched you a little bit over the weekend, and you've got a little quote here on the Collegiate Football page.
Yes, yes.
Which says, I'm a big believer in practicing what you preach, and mm-hmm. getting back into sport on a competitive level allows me to show my students that I'm not asking them to do anything that I'm not prepared to do myself.
Yep.
And it probably just hits a nail on the head with what you were just saying there.
Yeah, and even now, like going back to playing footy, we had a bye this weekend, and I rocked up to training on Tuesday, and only half the group was there. And I was just like, well, where is everyone? They're like, oh, we've got a bye. And I'm like, so? You know, I'm in my 40s. If you had told me I didn't have to be, I would have said, yeah, no worries. But it was just, you know, whether it's just practice that was drilled in and that's what you just do. But I just couldn't, like, their response, oh, we've got a bye.
Yeah,
I was just bemused as to why you don't turn up for training.
And is that coming from, and I'm going to go back a little bit to when you were in Japan. I know we've spoken about this a little bit before, but is that the culture difference? When you were in Japan, you noticed a lot of differences in culture and the way that people were coached. Does that go back to those days and the habits you entrenched in those days as an athlete now you bring forward as a coach?
Yeah, definitely. I think no matter what the situation, no matter if you're injured, unless you were on your dying deathbed, you went to training because there was still something to learn. Whether you could get around, whether you could listen, whether you could assist, whether you could do something, that was always ingrained in me. So it wasn't, oh, I'm not feeling so great, I'll get mum or dad to call on my behalf or I'll text the coach. It was real, you turn up, you still try and do as much as you could, but unless you were really dying, that was the only time you didn't go to training.
Yeah, and so let's talk about the coaching over there because, I mean, I've coached in Australia and in Asia, and the cultural differences between the way we go about it here and over there is obviously really different. Do you have any stories about, you know, when you're back over there and, you know, things that happened throughout training?
Oh, definitely. I had a play that I'd come up with just on my own thinking this will work, but it's very flamboyant play, you know, it's not one in the book that you're going to see, and the Japanese are all about basics, but they're happy to do a play like that. But my coach, when I said it to him, because it's only in a play where if the game goes into extra time,
yep.
So you know it's called a tiebreaker, so the runner starts at second base, and I had an idea to confuse the base runner so that someone could slip in, and it was like a trick play, and he understood it. He said, that's great, but we have to practice it 1,000 times. So it took me 18 months over there. He gave me about 5 to 10 minutes of every training to practice, and he'd get his little book out called, you know, Titcomb Son's book, and he would literally dash down every single time we practiced it, and he wouldn't let us do it unless we did it 1,000 times. The only problem was I used it against Japan in the 2008, and we didn't practice it in the Aussie team once.
Oh, wow.
We went out into the 11th inning, and I said to Wardy and to Sandy, the pivots at the time, I said, look, I've been practicing this play in Japan. My teammates know it, but we're not allowed to use it there. But it works. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Literally 2 minutes before we went out there, we ran the play. It worked. We got them out. We got out of the inning. And which was hilarious because then we went back to Japan and my coach said, I saw you use that play. It was all that practice. but yeah, and that was only after 700 times, you know. He still didn't let us use it because he said they all know the secret now.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, it's high repetition over there, isn't it?
Like massive repetition.
Yeah.
But they still do it with high intensity. Like I sort of thought, you know, when you first get there and the coach is saying, hit 500 balls off a tee, I'd be like, all right, better pace myself. And I'd look at my teammates though. There was no pacing going on. Yep. It was the same intensity, the same level every time they hit the ball off the tee. So, yes, they do things a lot, but they do it with a high intensity and a real focus.
Yeah.
When they're finished, you know, as you could imagine, you're stuffed, you're bored.
Yeah.
But they video everything, the way they analyse everything. I learnt so much about my own game because they broke mine down, were able to rip me apart. So,
yeah, yeah.
My own teammates are telling me how the opposition are going to throw for me.
Yeah.
So I was prepared because they would actually break it down and say, this is how they're going to throw against you, Nat. So I learnt so much to change. And, you know, at a, you know, when I first got my opportunity as a professional athlete at 30, you don't consider that you have to change too many things that you do. You know, you're already a two-time Olympian. You've been successful. They want you. You know, I didn't expect that I'd have to go over there and change, but I did, and it was all for the better, and it was a great learning experience.
Was there ever a paralysis by analysis situation over there where they analyse things too much as coaches?
Definitely, and I'd just have to say to my teammates, I'd make them laugh sometimes and go, you got to move on from this, like that's not going to change,
yeah.
You know, go and do something silly.
Yeah.
And I guess the coaches over there would allow me to do that because he'd see them more relaxed and we'd perform.
Yeah.
But if they didn't perform, it was straight back on you.
Yeah.
You know, well, yep. No, that doesn't work. And they don't kind of have that flexibility if it fails. If it works, they're all for flexibility. But if it fails, they're like, no, go back to what we know.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I want to now go into the, obviously as an athlete, you had so many great experiences and then you obviously now are entrenched in coaching, which is great, and obviously still competing as a footballer, which is awesome. But you obviously coaching now and leading young kids down the path that obviously you've walked before. How has your experience as an athlete shaped how you've become in your philosophy as a coach?
Look, I think I'm still learning my philosophy.
Yeah.
One of the things that I like to do, and I know that I've done it probably in the past 2 years, is almost sit back and let the athletes show me how motivated they are to be better.
Yeah.
Because it's a very difficult thing. If you're not willing to put in effort, if you're not willing to put in the work, I don't think you can be coached. So for me, I'm sitting back saying, if you know, a lot of kids are handed a lot of stuff, but you know, there's a million kids in your area. It's the ones who want it more than anything else. They're the coachable ones. They're the ones that can be changed. So I look at work ethic. I look at self-motivation is massive.
Yep.
I know as your job, it's kind of your role as a coach to motivate. But, I mean, I look back at some of my coaches and they motivated you with fear. they motivated you in a different sense. But they motivated you because you were willing to put in an effort. You were willing to show that you could change. You were willing to do a lot of things where I think I'm still learning that approach with kids these days because they are different.
It is different. It's a different era we do live in. And obviously with so many different options available to our, especially in Australia, our kids have so many different ways of going. We have to keep them motivated in what they're doing at that particular moment because their mind wanders a lot. And
yeah.
And obviously, like, you know, how did you then, though, get into coaching? Obviously, you went into teaching,
yeah.
Which obviously is coaching, but you've gone into teaching and then into coaching. What motivated you to get into coaching?
I think just an essence to see someone perform. Like to see something click in a kid or a student it's a great appreciation. You know, I don't have kids, I've got dogs, but teaching a dog to sit and take a treat is just as rewarding.
Yeah.
And I think kids are exactly the same. You know, that I've been given an opportunity with the career that I've had as an athlete. Mm-hmm. There is so much information embedded in my brain that I didn't think that it would be right if I didn't share it. And I think that that was probably something that was instilled in me and the coaches that I had. Every coach I had, apart from in my professional career, wasn't paid. You know, they were there because they wanted to be there. And I think that that's something that I'll always want to give back, is that sense that everyone that coached me did it because they wanted to, not because they were paid to do it or because it was a career opportunity. They did it because they wanted to instill something in somebody else.
Because softball isn't notoriously a big money sport.
No.
So, you know, these obviously the athletes and the coaches themselves are doing it because of the passion. And you are a very passionate person in general. So I love the way that you've talked about this, because I want you to elaborate a little bit more. The passion that you've had, has that rubbed off on you now to go, well, these coaches have shown so much faith in me and so much effort they've put towards my career. I just want to give back because I think the sport deserves it.
Yeah, and I think I'm in a better position now. I mean, working at a sports school where you're surrounded and, you know, almost submerged in a sporting culture, you can't not be excited.
Yeah.
And I think I'm just excited by seeing other coaches, by seeing really professional athletes at such a young age. You know, I used to love it when I'd go and do talks after coming back and having my 15 minutes of fame after every Olympics, and the kids would be like, you know, they were the best ones to put you back where you needed to be. You know, you'd go in, they'd go, there's an Olympian here, whoa, you know. And then they'd say, she's a softballer, oh. You know, then they'd say, she won a medal, whoa. Oh, it was only bronze, oh. You know, so kids are just unbelievable at going, well, this is what it really is.
Yeah.
And even kids these days, you know, oh, you must have made so much money, you're an Olympian, you've got medals. I'm like, it used to cost me $20,000 a year to go and play for my country.
Yeah.
And they're like, what? I said, yeah, not one match payment ever. You know, I never got paid to play a match. So I think that is something that I think people just assume, that you've made money because you've been successful. And I kind of laugh at, you know, now I'm playing in the amateurs and I've got my coffee vouchers. That's my match payments. And I'm taking full advantage of it. Don't you worry about that. My 2 a week that I get. So, no, so I mean, that's a massive difference in I guess, people's perception about what is being successful.
It's easy from the outside looking in, isn't it, to judge people? And I think we all do it when we watch a footy game on the weekend.
Yep.
And we can sit on the outside and judge people, but on the inside, it's you know, as you know, it's not easy. It's you know, a lot of hard times and a lot of down times.
And not even having, like, you know, you never have medical staff on hand at training. Like, we would rarely have a physio or training or a trainer at training. So if you injured yourself at training, it was self-managed. It was get yourself through training, get yourself to a physio as quickly as you could. You know, just those little things now. I mean, the kids at our school, as you know, they've got, you know, a dietitian, sports psychologist, they've got physios on site, they've got phys prep who are writing all their programs. I mean, there is nothing that they need to walk any further than 100 metres for.
Yeah, it's all there.
And so that's something that I do always constantly have in the back of in my mind, to sort of say they're going to have to learn these tasks because we're not teaching them, we're giving them.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to learn it at some point.
How important is that to you as a coach now to, you know, obviously when kids are given so much, you know, they're not there to have to fight for what you did in Japan, you know, going over there and living over in a country where you didn't know the language, having nothing at your doorstep apart from maybe the bat and the ball and the glove.
Yeah.
You know, and these kids here have got so much given to them.
I think they just have not the greatest sense of where they are. I think they'll rank themselves higher than where they actually are because they do look at themselves as small fish, big pond. So I think always constantly getting them to research their own sport, getting them to research the kids within our academy, understanding that, you know, sport is like being an actor. You know, you can only really name 10.
Yeah.
You know, and being an elite sports person, and you have to be playing the right sport. And there are so many sports out there. You know, there's probably 50, 60 sports out there that are at higher level. And I think people get caught up in, I play one of the biggest sports, but you're also in a bigger pool, so you need to take that into account.
Absolutely. So what lessons have you learnt along the way from other coaches that you've been able to utilise in your coaching?
I guess honesty. You know, the actual communication that you have with the coach, that it should be on a personal level. It shouldn't be, you know, I'm always trying to instill maturity in my group. So it's not just that I hate the whole text message can't make training.
Yeah.
I give them a blanket 24 hours notice to let me know, either personally, ringing or email. They're not allowed to text message me to say that they're not coming to training.
Yeah.
So that's one of the big things I think that I learned. I remember a story, when I was in the, you know, under 16 state team, my first year, I was just messing about. My dad just, you know, he's like, Nat, we need to leave at 10 past seven. Yeah. I was just, you know, fart-assing around, doing nothing. And my dad just drove off. And I thought, oh, he'll come back. He's just gone around. He's playing one of these tricks. No. So my training was meant to be at Moore Park. Now, I lived in Penrith, which was a good hour and 20 minutes from Moore Park.
Yeah.
And, you know, training was meant to start at 9 o'clock, finish at 4 o'clock. So I thought, you know, after the first half hour, I thought, Dad's not coming back. And what do I do? That was the day where there was no phone. I hadn't had a key to the house. As I came out, I closed the door behind me. So I was locked out of the house, no phone. My mum was at work and my dad's just driven off. And there I am with my bag sitting on the front yard. And Dad's, you know, I just sort of went, well, it's 9 o'clock, I'd be at training, what would I be doing? So I went for a run around the block. Went over to the preschool and started, you know, whacking a ball up against the fence, doing my fielding drills. Just did a sort of training, had a break when I thought I'd have a break. My dad got home at 20 past five, as was the time, and he said to me, what'd you do? I said, well, I sat for a while because I thought you were playing a joke. And he goes, well, now you know it wasn't a joke. I said, I understand that, Dad. And he goes, so what did you do? I said, oh, I went through all the drills that I think we're going to do at training today. I hit off the tee. I did my fielding. I went for a run. I did some sprints. And he goes, good. He goes, now when you come inside, you have to call the coach.
Yeah.
And you have to explain why you weren't at training today. Because he said, I didn't let them know anything. I had to go in, call my coach, tell him that I wasn't prepared and that's why I wasn't at training and I'd never do it again. And that was when I was 14.
Wow, unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's a good lesson to learn when you're that age and, oh, geez.
I've never been late again. As you know, Super, I am always on time.
We are both the same. We're the first ones at school, I think.
That's exactly
so
right.
It's a big lesson to learn early on. So, you know, obviously learning to be prompt, to be respectful to your coaches and having the honesty and the communication are things that you value and are close to your heart as a coach.
Yeah, I always kind of learned that the worst thing that you could possibly do is be late because you're disrespecting the people that you have planned something for you.
Yeah.
You know, my dad always said, if you're early, what's the worst thing you can do? Is go up, shake their hand and say, hi, I'm early, I'm ready to go.
Yep.
I respect what you're doing for me.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, that's much better than coming up with an excuse about the traffic or something else.
There's always an excuse, isn't there?
There is. Oh, and as you've probably heard them all, as have I, you know, and teaching.
Absolutely.
There's always a reason.
The cat ate the homework.
That's it.
All right, so let's talk now. I'm going to ask you a question. I like hearing these sort of answers. Is what mistakes have you made as a coach early on? Because obviously you haven't coached a lot. What have you made along this way that you've gone, oh, geez, I wouldn't do that again?
Sometimes I've given them a bit too much rope.
Yep.
You know, and allowed the athletes to hang themselves in a way where probably I could have stepped in and you know, given them a bit more advice and, you know, things like that.
Yep.
Probably the hardest thing is removing yourself from being the athlete still.
Yeah.
And I think I'm still learning that, come on, you can do this. This is all you have to do. And I think simplifying it for me is not simplifying it for them because they don't have the experience.
Yeah.
So I guess learning back to how do I teach and break this down for this 14, 15-year-old, not 25, 26-year-old Nat, who could make very simple adjustments. So I think that's a massive learning curve for me to go back and break it down bit by bit.
Yeah.
What was the question again?
Mistakes you've made along the way.
Probably assuming that they're at a higher level or assuming that they understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, because all kids look like they're a deer in the headlights. And when you've asked how many kids a question, they all nod their heads and go, yeah, super.
Yeah.
I understand. but they really don't.
Exactly.
So I think that's been, you know, I think deep down knowing they don't have a clue.
Absolutely. I think assuming is something that as coaches we all do.
Mm.
We just assume, like, even if, you know, you start a new year and you've got new players that come into your program, we assume that they've already heard the information you've told for so many years. And I think it's a real big mistake that a lot of us do make. And I know I make it a lot, and sometimes I catch myself doing it. But, you know, we have these new athletes that come in. We've got to almost go back a step for those new athletes all the time and not assume, like you're saying.
No, and most of the athletes we get at such a young age, their coaches have been their parents.
Yep.
And their parents come from so many different backgrounds, you know, that aren't trained in, you know, I guess the terminology that we use and the things that we say. So I think that's a massive thing as well. So sort of going, okay, these kids haven't had elite coaches yet. They haven't had elite conversations or statements made at them or anything like that. They've had mum or dad be the one to put the ball on the tee, be the one to pick up the balls at the tennis court, be the one to do whatever.
Yeah.
It's been mum and dad.
Yeah.
And they're the most supportive person that you can have in your group. That's and right. the most frustrating at the same time. Because if you're having a bad day and they've stopped you from doing something, well, they're the worst person in the world.
Exactly. So then let's now look at, I've got a question that I ask a lot of coaches is, what do you see in other coaches that you cringe at that you probably did? But maybe we could, if you haven't seen a lot in that, or maybe some coaches that you had that you thought, oh God, this guy's going to talk again, or this is what he's going to say, I know what he's going to say and how he's going to say it. What do you cringe at as a coach when you see others doing it?
I think stopping when momentum is happening in a session.
Yeah.
You know, we used to have a coach that would just talk so much, and it was kind of like, I'm getting cold. Like, you know, we'd have a great session going, there'd be so much momentum, there'd be so much positivity, and then the coach would stop it. And I'd be like, don't stop, this is working, everyone's working so well.
Yeah.
So that would be one thing that I think I saw in the past. Another one was just bringing their anger to training, you know.
Emotional coaching,
you know, it's not the athlete's problem that you've had a bad day.
Yeah.
And I guess I do the same in teaching.
Yeah.
I often do a little mental well-being curve on my board every time I walk in. I let the students know where I'm at in a 1 to 10. 10 being feeling great physically, mentally, everything. 0 being feeling really bad. And I often say to the students, it doesn't matter whether I'm a 2 or I'm a 10, I'm still capable of teaching you today.
Yeah.
Whether I've had a bad day, whether something's happened, you know, there might have been a death, my partner might be sick, something like that. I might go into, you know, my year 10 class and go, look, I'm a 4, but it doesn't mean that I'm not capable. And I said, it's the same with you. When you're feeling down, when you're feeling not great, it doesn't mean that you're not capable of putting out a great performance.
That's the human element of coaching, isn't it? Like, we all have bad days. We all have days where we're feeling great. I think it's important that we try and neutralize ourselves when we go into a room and talk to people. And we've got to learn to take the emotion out of the messaging. And I think that's a huge one, that, you know, the best coaches in the world can take the emotion out of their message. And I see that a lot in AFL, just being involved.
Yeah.
And I actually see that in the way that you speak to people. And I love the way you go about it, because you're very unemotional.
Yeah.
Is that
I'm probably a bit blunt at times.
Blunt, unemotional, same thing to me. No, but I think, is that something you learnt along the way, or is that you as a person?
I don't know. I think, I mean, my greatest mentor was my dad.
Yeah.
Like, he was the most honest, integrity guy that you'd come across. And he would take emotion out of it. He'd be saying, look, you've struck out 3 times. There's no use cracking the shits and throwing your bat away.
Yeah.
That's not going to help anyone.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I mean, most of the time we're teaching elite adolescents. They don't have the negotiation skills. They do make all their decisions based on emotion because their brains haven't formed yet. So I guess knowing this information, I know that if I'm emotional, a kid's going to get twice as emotional twice as quickly if I try and teach that way. So you've got to really take it out, but you've got to understand that there's a massive possibility that they're going to be at training with high emotion or low emotion or whatever they're sort of doing.
Well, how do you then, as a coach, neutralize their emotion before you actually deliver your message? Do you have any tips for the coaches that are listening on this podcast to say, well, you're going to talk to athletes that are in the heat of battle at times, they're going to be, you know, at training and can't get things right. How do you take that emotion out of your messaging and out of them before you even start the message?
Yeah, I just sort of say, whether you're feeling great, whether you're not, let's break down and do one skill today that you know that you can achieve.
Yeah, I like that.
And instead of trying to make them, you know, US Open champion straight away, just sort of saying, okay, I can see that where you are today.
Yep.
What's something that you're good at?
Yep.
Let's do that today. And let's do that for the first 10 minutes. It might build a bit of confidence. It might do something for them. Then you may be able to implement another skill and say, okay. You know, so I think giving them something that they can be really positive about, because there's no use going out and saying, right, this is the skill you hate most. You're already having a crap day. Let's do that skill for the first 10 minutes because you're going to lose them. They're going to hate you.
Yeah.
And as I said, being adolescents, they're not coming back in a hurry.
It's a great message. I think that's a really good message for any coach out there listening is, you know, get the athletes to play to their strengths, utilize their strengths. It makes them feel good. It gets them confident. And if they're confident, then the session will run a lot better. And like you said, they'll continue to come back because they want to, not because they have to.
So it's kind of like, you know, the sandwich feedback. Give them something fun at the beginning. Test them, try them, give them a different sauce that they don't really like. Then give them something good at the end, you know, put the cheese on top and then say, there you go. How's that?
I had a coach say to me a couple of years ago, and I'm not going to mention who it was, but he was in an emotional state. A game was not going the way that we wanted it to go. And I said, what's the information we're going to give the players? And he said, we're going to do this, this, and this. And it was negative, positive, negative. I said, what about the feedback sandwich? And he said, stuff them. Stuff them. This sandwich is inside out. And I just said, okay, we'll take that. That's fine.
At least he was aware what he was doing.
Absolutely. He knew it.
And maybe, you know, I often hear, you know, I watch football just like everyone else. I love it on the weekend. And you often hear players say, some people deal well with the spray. Some people don't. And you have to sort of work out for your athletes which ones that is, not just go, I reckon that kid can handle it.
Yeah.
I think you really do need to get to know an athlete before you give them a rocket.
How do you do that? What's your tips of how do you get to know athletes? You know, a lot of people have different ways. What's your way of doing it?
I think it's seeing how aggressive or passive they become on a field. Mm. You know, go and watch them play. Just don't assume that they're going to play like they train, because obviously that can be quite different. I mean, in my career, I've had some girls that have been amazing trainers. When we played warm-up matches, when we did everything, they were like best in our team. Put them in under pressure, they go passive. They go internal. So obviously they're not the type of player who you're going to give a rocket to.
Yep.
Anyone who goes internal under pressure, they're not going to do it. You almost want to give a rocket to the guy who's going to tackle someone so hard or swing out of their shoes or something like that. They can handle a rocket because they're an aggressive. They're actually wanting to show emotion.
Yeah.
So they're going to understand if you show emotion because they're the same type. Where if they're passive, you could be yelling at them and nothing's going on.
And it probably goes the other way, doesn't it? It has the opposite effect on those athletes and they go in their shell a bit more.
And they're the type of athletes who are self-analyzing themselves. Yeah. 1,000 more times than what you will.
Yeah.
And you'll get to the end of a conversation, they'll be like, oh, no, I'm still thinking about what happened 15 minutes ago.
Yeah,
and you're like,
that's right.
What?
Yeah, exactly right.
You know, haven't you moved on from there? Well, no.
No. They hang on to that stuff.
Yeah.
We got a little segment here. It was actually named by our first guest on this show, Torrin Baker, and we called it the Fast Play of the Week. We could call it the base steal of the week for you here. So we're going to go pretty quickly on these ones. We want sort of sharpish answers, so we'll see how we go. Question one is, what's the most important characteristic for a successful athlete?
Preparation.
Preparation. Love it. And then question two is, what is the most important characteristic for a successful coach?
Preparation.
We're into the preparation phase. Love it. Your favorite resource that coaches that are listening to this podcast can obtain to learn a little bit more about coaching?
YouTube. Yeah. There is so much information out there. You have to do what works for you. Like, long-winded answer.
We'll take it.
But as a teacher, we're given a curriculum. Each teacher is going to teach that curriculum different to what works for them. It's the same with any video that you watch. So if you're watching a video saying, this drill looks amazing, it's the way that the coach has set it up, the way they're prepared, it's going to be different. So don't ever think that just because you've set up the drill how it is on the video that it's going to work.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you may have to tweak it to work for you and your athlete.
Yeah, I love that. Great message. Can you recommend to our audience someone to follow on social media that you think has some really good messages around coaching? Obviously, we've got a lot of, hopefully,
well,
some really...
Mark's a fool, so I follow him myself. He's not, great he's at bad. Little motivational quotes every now and then.
I try.
I think past players, I mean, always have some great things to say. Like, personally, I have Lauren Jackson. I follow her on Twitter.
Yep.
Aaron Phillips is another one now who's doing that transition from still coaching in basketball to still playing. So she's still sharing a message. But she's also sharing a message about life. And I think that that's really important, that, you know, you need to actually take time out and live.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. Yes, she'll put some things up there that are specific to basketball and football, but she's also letting us know that she has another life, and I think that that's really important. So follow a coach who has exterior things going on in their life and just aren't submersed the entire time, because they must be stressed, is what I think.
Absolutely. And the coaches that are the best coaches actually teach life lessons in their coaching as well. So it is a really important asset for a coach to have.
Definitely.
You answered this before, and I know I'll probably get the same answer again. Who is the greatest influence on you as a person?
As I said, my dad. You know, just Mr. Honesty. He never, you know, I'd have a bad game and I'd be self-analysing myself or being annoyed at myself, and he'd just say, well, what would you change?
Yeah.
You know, can you go back and change it? No. So he goes, well, what do you change moving forward? And he was just so simple.
Yep.
Like, very simple in what he would say, or I could always take in his information, because he never raised his voice. He'd never be critical.
Mm.
He'd always say, wasn't your best.
Yeah.
But he goes, it wasn't your worst.
Yeah.
You know, so he was never, like, overly critical about me. And then he was there to say, well, do you want some help?
Yeah.
Real supporting, you know. So I think that that's a really important thing. And he also knew never to do the let's talk in the car on the way home thing.
That's my pet hate, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm a parent now, and I don't ever want to be that parent.
No, my mum used to be the let's talk in the car about the whole world and about every at-bat that you had, and it would just frustrate you.
Yeah.
Where my dad would just, he would just let yourself reflect.
Yeah, it's
good. You'd talk about it, and then you'd move on.
Yeah.
So,
I like that.
Yeah.
So, who's been your greatest influence as a coach then?
Oh, look, I had a guy called Barry Blanchard, and he was, I was always, I guess, always into the older coach, like way older, old school kind of coach, because they just didn't take any bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't care in a way that, you know, this is the 50th ball that you've hit. He goes, you know, because you'd hit one and he'd go, see, that's number 51, still hitting it as good as 50,
yep.
You know, or number one. So, Barry was, he was just any time, he probably had the most flexible time schedule, I think, because he was retired, he was semi-retired. So he worked around my schedule, so he's probably one of the greatest assets that I could have, because during uni, during my work, I'd just be leaving school if I had a break and say, look, I've got an hour, can we do some hitting? And he would just come to a park near my school and we'd just hit for half an hour and then I'd run back to class.
Yeah.
Even if he had to travel like 45, 50 minutes to be there, set up before I got there. So I'd virtually get out of my car, quick warm up, hit, go back to work. I mean, that was just stuff that, you know, without him, I don't think I would have been able to get the reps or the basics right.
And I love that question, because if I'm sitting down, listening to a podcast in 20 years' time, I'm hoping someone says that about me as a person and as a coach, because I think it's why we do the job. We do the job because, you know, we want to help someone else, and we don't expect the rewards, but
no.
I think at the end of the day, when someone can go back and go, wow, this person really helped me, I think it's what we do the job for. And it's a nice thing to hear.
And
so
being a coach and being a teacher is exactly the same thing. It's the most selfless job in the world.
Yeah, it is.
You know, kids don't appreciate what you've done to them until they look back at their careers or look back at their school life and 100%. Go, wow, that teacher or that coach actually made life better for me.
Absolutely. That's amazing. What is the most valuable lesson you have learnt along your journey?
I think the one that Dad taught me about, you know, if you make a mistake, be responsible for it.
Be responsible, yeah.
And don't try and hide it. You know, as I said, as soon as I got home, he said, "Here's the phone. You know the number. Call your coach. Let them know that you've done wrong, and let them know that you won't do it again."
Yeah, we all make mistakes.
We all make them.
Yeah, and we just got to own up to it and be responsible and take responsibility for our actions.
I mean, I played a game that if you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're still amazing. You know, you had to have a 300 batting average is 3 out of 10.
Yeah.
If I asked you, Soups, to play, you know, tennis and only get 3 out of 10 serves in, I'd be crap at tennis. But in softball, baseball world, to get 3 out of 10, I mean, the averages are against you. You've got 8 people in front of you on a diamond-shaped field.
Yeah.
So if you can find the hole 3 out of 10 times, you're actually doing really well.
My tennis game is 3 out of 10, and so is my golf game when you're talking about getting in the hole. So I struggle at both of those. So thanks for bringing that up, man. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
You have answered this throughout the time, but what is the best part of coaching?
I think just seeing that light bulb moment. If you can get one light bulb moment a session, whether it be the kid with the most talent or the kid with the least amount of talent in your group, you're winning as a coach.
Yeah.
And usually we're coaching for an hour, hour and a half at the time. You would hope that there could be possibly a light bulb moment every day.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I've had plenty of light bulb moments sitting here talking to you, Nat. One last question in our base deal of the week is, what would your athlete say is your one favourite coaching quote that you always use?
Becky could probably answer this because he probably hears me more than anyone. Probably if you're standing around doing nothing, you're not getting any better.
That's good.
That's probably the biggest thing. There's always something to do.
Yep.
You know, and I think that's what I definitely learned in Japan, because you weren't even allowed to really go and do it. You weren't allowed to sit for 6 hours.
Yep.
Unless you were stretching. So there was a lot of the old hamstring stretch going on at occasion when you were buggered. But you weren't allowed to sit, so it was always you had to be looking like you were doing something. And I think that's what I learned, is that body language and perception is huge, because people are going, wow, she's fit, she doesn't sit down, she's, you know, she's able to train as a 30-year-old with these 18-year-old kids. You know, and I think those actions right there, of me taking that on board and saying, oh, I don't need to be the special foreign player. I'm just going to, that's the rule for the team, and I'm going to abide by it.
Yeah. Now, you've got an amazing answers here, Nat.
The other one is rotate through the hips. I hear that.
Rotate through the hips.
Bloody use your legs. You know, hitting's just not about your arms. So
they're all coming out now.
They're all coming out. Thanks, Rebecca.
All coming out now. All right. It has been absolutely awesome spending some time with you. I want you to give yourself a bit of a pump up. What's happening in Nat Titcomb's life at the moment? Where are you going with things? You know, what's next on your agenda? I know, is it Huntington's disease that you are very close? It's close to your heart with Kylie.
Yep.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, look, my partner has Huntington's disease, which is in the same family as the MND, which we know through the Danaher family how you know, horrible that disease is. There's no other way to put it. But Kylie's been in Huntington's disease, is that virtually since she was diagnosed 3 years ago, she's virtually got 10 years to live. And when we talk about 10 years of life, it's not actually living the 10 years either. You know, she'll be in a wheelchair. There'll be a whole lot of other things that are, that happen. You know, she'll lose her speech. She'll, you know, she's already can't drive now. So you start to lose your independence gradually, which is the hardest thing. So for me, getting back into that club atmosphere, which has been great with my footy, having that belonging and that sense of making people aware. And I think it gives a massive sense of perspective to all the young athletes that I'm now with, and just getting out there and having a run around. They're learning about perspective. You know, wins and losses are great. Don't worry, I'm still as competitive as hell when I get out there, and I'm loving the tackling.
Yeah.
But yeah, sort of, you know, I'm tackling HD in my real life every day.
Mm.
And on the weekend, I get to go and have fun with 22 other girls and run around and, sorry, the opposition, but get to tackle them as hard as I bloody can. And that's what makes it fun for me. So yeah. I guess that's now my drive. That's why I do it. You know, luckily in our family, Kylie will be the last one to have Huntington's.
Yeah.
We haven't got children. Her sister doesn't have it, so it can't be passed on. So,
that's nice.
You know, she's almost been the flag, the last flag bearer of a family, you know, we had to watch her father pass away very slowly. So Kylie's really taken it in a stride. And so it's my job, I guess, to be very positive.
Absolutely.
And to try and bring, you know, Kylie in a sense of belonging and have a great life, you know, and being around a footy club. I was very anti-footy club, like, to be totally honest. I was a bit of a boys' club, a bit of a men's club. But I think with women's involvement in footy, just being around the club, in speaking to some of the male players and the presidents and whatever have been around, they said women coming into footy, into dressing rooms, into club rooms, has been amazing in a sense that, you know, boys, men are becoming men. You know, they're becoming more aware of what it is to actually be a man.
Yeah.
So I think that real boys sort of, you know, what boys do, I think it's starting to leave and they're actually becoming men. So I think that was a really nice conversation that I had around Anzac Day the other week where I was happy, like I was lucky to be involved in an Anzac Day, you know, footy match.
Awesome.
And that was awesome. But hearing that these guys are actually being men now, I think is a great asset for women in sport.
For the world.
For the world, yeah, I think it's a great thing.
It's a great thing. So how do we as listeners and as people in the general public get to know a little bit more about Huntington's disease and how can we help out in any way?
Yeah, well, there's a website obviously for Huntington's Victoria, so you just go to huntingtonsvictoria.org. There's a ball coming up on the 27th of October, which I am the MC for, and I've been the MC for a few years. It's about raising money. It's about raising awareness, but it's a really great night. We have it at Zinc at Fed Square every year. Last year, we had about 450 people. We like to keep it close. We like to keep the prices down so that people in the Huntington community can come. So it's not an extraordinary night, but if you have people who are interested in coming along, there's lots of auction items. Every bit of funding goes back to helping someone with Huntington's disease. So it doesn't necessarily go to research. It actually goes to resources for them. So it could be a chair. It could be some dinnerware. It could be something that, you know, obviously, as I said, it's a motor neuron disease. So you lose lots of function. You're swallowing, walking, standing. So a lot of the money goes back to actually helping people in our community.
That's an awesome thing that you are doing, Nat. If anybody out there listening, I hope someone listens to the whole of my podcast here. but if anyone does, let's try and get behind this great cause. And if you've got anything to donate, we'll be willing to take it on board and head it over to Nat and the crew. That'd be awesome. So the last question I have for you is, can you recommend someone that you think would be awesome for me to interview? Not as good as you, obviously, but someone would be great to have on this podcast.
Good question.
It's a good question. I know I think we stumped a few people last few weeks, so I just want to see what you think.
I mean, I'm a Sydney Swans supporter, so Johnny Longmire at the top of my list.
There you go. John Longmire. Shebex, if you've got any contacts at the Sydney Swans.
Work on the horse.
I just think that, you know, he was somebody who came in already a successful organisation. And with pretty high expectation, you know, Paul Roos had just won a flag. He'd been a part of it. To then continue on and to actually keep recruiting and keep building those younger players, I think that he's done it in his own twist, but I just think that he's a fascinating person. He always just seems so calm.
Yeah, he does.
You never really see him rip into anyone. So
Johnny Longmire.
Johnny Longmire.
We're setting the bar here, Shebex. Let's see how we go. Well, it's been an awesome time here with you, Nat. I'm going to go through some of your key points so that the listeners out there who fast forward to the end of this podcast sometimes when I'm talking, they'll probably fast forward my stuff. Just give a bit of a little bit of a flashback here. So we talked about you understood between 2000 and 2008 that experience was a really big part of you as an athlete and getting the runs on the board. And then you took your time and didn't rush. I think it's really important. You're all about actions. There's always something to learn in practice, that no matter what, how you're injured or you're sick, there's always something to do and to learn. The differences in culture in the way that we coach, from the Japanese style to the Australian style, mm-hmm. where it's very repetition-based. Everything that you did over there was training with a purpose. There was obviously times where there was paralysis by analysis, where there was too much analysis going on, so we need to make sure we have a blend of what we teach our athletes. You like to let your athletes show you how motivated they are. That's one of parts of your philosophy. You like your athletes to be coachable, self-motivated, have a great work ethic, and you think it's really rewarding watching kids perform, which is part of being a coach. If you've got nothing to do, research your sport. You know, get out there. If you're an athlete out there, research your sport. If you're a coach out there, research your sport. Get some stuff that you can take back to your environment. Honesty, communication on a personal level, respect, and don't be late to messages and the things that you have learned along the way being a coach. Mistakes you made along the way were you gave too much rope, too much leniency at times. You should have probably stepped in at different times and given more advice. And remove yourself from being the athlete. And I think we all do that when we first transition from being an athlete to mm-hmm. a coach. We're still in that athlete mindset, so it's really important. To get athletes motivated, you get them to do something that they're really good at to make sure that we build their confidence and instill confidence within them. And the biggest thing, the last one I think is really important, is to understand your athletes. Watch them compete and see how they go about it to learn more about what they do. So, Natalie Tickham, it has been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks,
having Soups. You out here. And I think, Shebex, we're going to get some hits on this one because it's some great messages for not only coaches but athletes as well in the community. It's been a great 40-odd minutes of chat with you. I'm probably going to see you in the next hour back at school, so I won't say goodbye. I'll say see you later, and thank you for being here.
No problem. Thank you.
There you go, the Coach's Corner with Mark Sefoulis and Natalie Tipkin. If you'd like to hear more of our podcast, all you need to do is go to mypodcasthouse.com, and there's plenty there to choose from. Another Coach's Corner coming up next week.